We're very excited to have Rabbi Tetz join us tonight. And as Chemed, we are very proud to be able to host Rabbi Tetz and welcome him to speak at Chemed and to speak on who owns your body, medicine sphere and your body, what is the connection? Thank you very much.
First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to learn a bit together. Got a bit of laryngitis, so if you come and sit closer. I was asked to speak about the question of ownership of one's body. What does that mean in halacha? I think I'm supposed to connect it to the sphere as well, so I have to think about how to do that. But I guess ownership of one's body and connection to sphere really is that we are looking to move from the body to beyond the body. You know that Pesach is the time of the body itself. The korban is korban ha'omer, so that's animal. That's animal food. And spirit takes you to a level that's transcendent. No, one of the obvious questions in spirit is that we don't count the last day. The Torah says, Tisbru Chamishim Yom, you only count 49. What's one question? Another question is that we don't count the first day either, right? We start on the second day. Why does the spirit not start if it's from Pesach to Shavuos, which is clearly from birth in the animal situation to the transcendence of Torah? So how come we don't count the first day? Why do we start on the second day? And why don't we count the last day? One of the most basic ideas in Sphira is that we are moving to a situation that is beyond counting. If we counted the 50th day, we would be limiting it. We'd be making it one more number. And the point of the 50th is that it's beyond number. Right? Similar to Makkos. Makkos, the Torah says, Arba'im Yakenu, and we say it means 39. 40 does not mean 39. But you have a Mahalach in Torah where when the parts are put together correctly, something emerges that is greater than the sum of the parts. When you play the musical notes correctly, something happens which is music. You can't play the music, you don't play the notes. That's the key, by the way, in relationship with Hashem, to move into a world that is beyond the finite. The only way you can do it is by finite steps. So the first day of Pesach is not like that. That's completely out of this world. That's Yisarusa de Leila, it's done by Hashem, it's a night that's got the din of a day. That's certainly beyond count. Pesach means to leap over to that level. And then the work begins, walking through the desert day after day. And if each step is done correctly, you reach something that's transcendent, that is beyond count. If you counted it, you'd be killing it. The 50th is beyond counting. So if you want to understand the question of the body and what it should be used for, I guess the sphere is a very good opportunity to do that. So now I've done my duty, I spoke about sphere. And let's think about the question of ownership of the body. I'd like to try to show you some fascinating medical halachic applications. You're very welcome to ask questions. If I'm able, I'll do my best to answer. But perhaps we can begin like this. You know that in modern Israel, which, as you know, I don't have to tell you, unfortunately, is a secular society, and yet, very amazingly, there are some areas of medical law, medical ethical principles in Israel, maybe six or seven areas of law, that have two very unusual features. One feature is that they accord very well with halacha, amazingly, and the other is that they fly in the face of all other Western countries' medical ethical principles. That's very interesting. Many of these laws were suggested to the Knesset and accepted on the basis of a committee, about 50 people in Israel, including, and the decisions, the questions are put to Rabbi Yashiv as well, at the time of Shlomo Zalman, a committee of about 50 people, including one or two Arab members of parliament, professors of medicine, right-wing rabbonim. First of all, can you imagine 50 Israelis on a committee having to agree, you know, about life and death? You know, if that isn't a nightmare, I don't know what is. But amazingly, on most of these questions, they were almost unanimous. And the Knesset accepted, in one or two incredible cases, the Knesset even decided to be more conservative than the ultra-right-wing halachic position. If there's time, I'll try to tell you about some of that. But some of these laws, again, have this very unusual feature, that they agree well with halacha and do not agree with Western principles. One of these laws is a law by which an Israeli doctor can force a patient into treatment against his wishes. Right? Amazing thing. Under certain limited circumstances, not all of which accords with halacha, but under certain circumstances, you can force a person into life-saving treatment against their wishes, which is totally contrary to all Western countries' principle of autonomy, where you get to decide what happens to your own life, and yet you can do that. I'd like to tell you the background to this law, and where it coincides with halacha, and what some of its applications are. Before I do that, I just tell you that Israel, being a country that's not run according to halacha, I once had a very personal experience of that. You know, I was once on trial in an Israeli court. Now, you know, you're not allowed to say bad things about yourself, but when I tell you the details of the case, you'll see I was clearly right. And what happened was, I moved there to Israel a number of years ago, and for some years I never paid my car registration fees. You know, you've got to license your car, what you Americans call an automobile, but it's a car. And you have to pay your license fees every year, and I didn't pay them. You know, the notices used to come in Hebrew, and my Hebrew wasn't that slick, and then they came in red, and I ignored those, and eventually I was sued for contempt of court. And that's a serious crime. You can't pay a fine, you know, you've got to go to court. That's very serious. Two big fellows arrived at the door with a warrant for my appearance in court. And I had to appear in the Jerusalem District Court on trial for 4 years of defaulting on paying my car registration fees and contempt of court. I want to tell you, by the way, that if the judgment in Shemayim is anything like as severe as the Jerusalem District Court, you do not want to do any averus, okay? Because, you know, it's absolutely terrifying. Yeah? For 3 weeks, I didn't sleep. I was shaking. I lost weight. I was a nervous wreck. I was having nightmares. And finally, the day of the trial arrives, and I arrive in the Jerusalem District Court. You know, you don't have the dignity of a private trial. You know, it's public. So you sit there and you watch these trials going on, and you've got these squad criminals, they were handing out death sentences and torture, electric chairs. It was terrible. At least I think that's what was happening. And finally, they call my name, and shaking like a leaf, I stand up in the dock, and I look across and I see that the judge is a very kindly looking religious gentleman. He's wearing a black suit, he's got a black kippah on his head, and he looks at me in a very kind way, and in English he says to me, "Where are you from?" So I said, "From South Africa." So he said, "Oh, do you know my friends? This one, that one." We had a long talk about all his friends, and then he said, "You can go." He was very fair, this judge, very, very fair. I couldn't believe it. So as I turned to leave the dock, the prosecutor on duty, who is a police lawyer on duty that day, he says to the judge, "You can't do this. He's a criminal. This is Israel, right?" He tells the judge, "You can't acquit him. He's a criminal." So the judge says, "No, he's a new, he's Olech Hadash, he didn't understand, you know, we've got real criminals, let's get on with the real work." He said, "I'm not letting you do that. I insist that you convict him, because he's a criminal, he broke the law, and you cannot acquit him." So the judge calls me back, and he says, "You know, he's right, I have to sentence you. But I see you're a religious looking fellow, so I'm not going to sentence you according to Israeli law, I'm going to sentence you according to the Gemara." Isn't that amazing? And he gives me and the court a lecture about Shalo Yehei Choten Niska. He gives a little lecture to the court that you claim you're a new Olech Hadash, you didn't read the things, but there's no reason you should benefit from your crime. "I hereby fine you exactly what your license registration fees would have cost over the last 4 years." Is that amazing? I had to go to the court cashier and I had to pay exactly the money that I saved, right? Amazing. But I learned from that incident that Israel does not run according to halacha, right? The court system runs according to British Turkish law. It does not accord with halacha. I was just fortunate that I came across an individual who could use his discretion to use the correct form of law. And as you know, it's an issue when you go to courts like that, especially in Israel. But that is the point. And therefore, it's very remarkable that a number of life and death issues in Israel are predicated on halachic principles. And one of them is that you can force a patient into treatment against his wishes. The background to this is that in any other Western country, you have a hierarchy of medical ethical principles, right? The accepted principles that the non-Jewish world runs on, very universally, very broadly accepted. The principles are, first of all, autonomy. That means it's my life and I'll do what I want with it, right? Extremely classically American value. Don't tell me what to do. Do what I want with my life. Two, justice. That means you cannot do what you want with your life if it's not just. There's only one machine and more than one person needs it. That sort of problem. Three is called beneficence. That whatever you do must be for the good of the patient. And four, non-beneficence. You cannot do something that harms the patient. Those are the four principles. But there's no question that the paramount principle in all Western ethical thinking, particularly in America, is autonomy. So what I want done to myself, that is the prime way. In halacha, of course, it's not like that, as I'll try to explain. But that is how they function. This means that I, as a doctor, I've been in practice in situations where I've had a Christian patient who will not accept the blood transfusion. Right? You have the Jehovah's Witnesses, a sect of Christians. They believe that the Bible prohibits blood transfusion. They're completely wrong, of course. There's no recall for that. But they misinterpret. They interpret certain psukim. and they say that it's forbidden to have a blood transfusion. When I have had patients like that, patients bleeding to death, and they say to you, I will not have a transfusion, you have to stand back and you have to let the patient die. Right? You cannot give them a transfusion. Because whatever the patient wants. No, I was at a medical conference in California. One of the doctors there told me about a colleague of his who was a ER doctor in California. Late one night, 2 o'clock in the morning, a terminally ill AIDS patient came in respiratory failure. This man had said that if he was ever this ill, he did not want to be intubated and ventilated. But it was 2 in the morning, there was nothing in writing, the doctor was unsure what to do, so out of doubt, he put the patient on the ventilator. He's now being sued in California for wrongful life and assault. And if he loses the case, he'll lose his license to practice medicine in California, right? In the halacha, that's ridiculous, of course. But that is the value of autonomy. And therefore, if they refuse a blood transfusion, there's nothing you can do. It's my life. You cannot touch me. You transfuse a person like that, they sue you for assault. What has not, where American law does agree with halacha, here's with regard to a child. I live in England now. British law and American law is consistently ruled that you override the parents' wishes when it comes to a minor. So if a child needs a blood transfusion or chemotherapy or whatever it is, the parents refuse based on religious principles, you overrule the parents and you transfuse the child. The language in American law is that the state has an interest in the survival of the child, which is paramount and trumps the parents' religious convictions. What's not clear is a fetus. I was in Atlanta some time ago. I had to give a talk in the home of a person who is the head of anesthesiology at a hospital in Atlanta. He told me one morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, he got a pregnant woman bleeding badly. She needed a transfusion to save the fetus. They weren't so concerned about her life. The problem was she was going to lose the pregnancy. She said, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. Do not transfuse me. They said to her, your baby's going to die. She said, it's God's will. He told me he phoned up a judge at 3 o'clock in the morning. He said, I want you to get out of bed. You signed me a court order authorizing forcible transfusion. The hospital security held the lady down. They transfused her and saved the fetus. Okay? That is with regard to a fetus. It's a question of judgment. When it comes to a child, you can override the parent's wishes. But when it comes to an adult, there's nothing you can do. The person wants to die. That is the case. In American law today, if a patient refuses food, you cannot force them to eat. You have a psychiatric assessment. If a psychiatrist testifies that the patient has what they call capacity, that means they are mentally competent, you let them die. Right? Halakhically, we regard that as a medical failure. The patient needs treatment of his depression. But there's nothing you can do. In England, by the way, in England it's even more extreme. In England, the doctor can refuse to feed the patient, let alone the patient. In England, a doctor can declare feeding as medically futile. And if the doctor tells the family that feeding is medically futile, then he's allowed to refuse to feed the patient, because you can't force a doctor to do something medically futile. And very ill patients in England starve to death because you cannot. The major application of that law is where the feeding requires a tube or some procedure. Then the doctor can clearly refuse. Right? Simply feeding the patient is not so clear. Anyway, it's a very bitter battle about this. But the point is that in American law and secular, all over the West, you cannot force the person into treatment. That's the situation. In halacha, it's not like that. We have many, many precedents in halacha, many shalos and shuvos, where you see that a person can be forcibly treated in many circumstances, and I'll try to explain where one cannot, what the exceptions are. But the general principle is that if someone's dying and they refuse to have their life saved, you can force them into treatment, because we basically do not understand that our life and our body belongs to us. Right, that's what many, like Buzz and many others, put it like that. And therefore, you cannot allow someone to die, and you are required to treat them. There are interesting discussions about this. Many folks can discuss the fact that if a person is trying to commit suicide, there's a sforah to say that you should allow them. Many say because part of the halacha of treating a patient is really learned from Hashavas Aveda, and Hashavas Aveda doesn't apply when the person doesn't want his Aveda. So if a person throws away something, you don't have to give it back to him. If he's throwing away his life, according to this sforah, you wouldn't have to give it back to him. But there are plenty of other makaris for having to treat people and to save life, and therefore we don't hold that way. There is a bit of a question if you have to put yourself in danger. How much danger do you have to undertake to prevent a suicide? Maybe that makes a difference. There are discussions like that. But basically, your life is not your own. Let's see if we can put this into context. There are some very interesting and challenging, very stimulating sources for this. One source is this. Do you know that Rabbi Zevin, right? Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin was a very creative thinker. He wrote some very amazing, he wrote on the Yom Tovim. He wrote some very interesting stuff. He has an amazing analysis of The Merchant of Venice. You know that Shakespeare's very anti-Semitic play, right, in which the Shylock, although Shakespeare probably never met a Jew, Shakespeare lived around the time, you know, Jews were expelled from England for hundreds of years, but he has this play about Shylock, the Venetian Jew, who's a moneylender, and he lends money to Antonio on condition that if Antonio cannot repay the loan, Shylock will carve out a pound of flesh as his guarantee for the loan. And of course, as the drama unfolds, the loan falls due, and Antonio cannot pay the loan, and Shylock takes him to a court in Venice to force his right to carve out a pound of flesh. So Rav Zevin analyzes the contract in Halacha. Very interesting. In detail, Gomash goes through the whole contract. There were others who had done this before him, and he shows why they're wrong. Worth looking up. Fascinating halachic discussion. It brings many, many interesting Rishonim to talk about this. And he comes to the conclusion that the contract's invalid in halacha. Not because Antonio will die, but because he doesn't own his body in the first place. And you cannot pledge collateral as of a loan for something that's not yours. Right? So, look it up. It's a very, very interesting source. I think it was printed in Tel Aviv, maybe, many, many years ago. But you can access it, and today all you need is a Oetzer Chochma, and you can be a magic Thomas Chochma. Just have it all at your fingertips. So I think it, I'm not sure it's there, but I think it is. So that's a wonderful source. In the course of this discussion, he mentions many things. One thing he mentions, which is a fascinating Rabbaz says that as you know in Halacha, you cannot incriminate yourself, right? You cannot testify about yourself. So in America, you call that the Fifth Amendment. Right? Except in Halacha, in American law, you can confess if you wish, only you cannot be required to. But as you know in Halacha, even if you try to, you cannot convict yourself, right? Even if you're required to do palgin et dvorot, for example, if a person says that he committed a sexual offense with someone else, so we accept the edus about the other party, we won't accept it about him, because we can believe your edus about somebody else, but who is the party that he did this with? Someone. We don't know who that was, right? That's clear. So you can't do it. So Rabbaz points out that this law of not being able to say edus on yourself, actually, this law actually applies only in criminal cases, but not in civil cases. That means if it's a financial case, and you want to admit to embezzlement or fraud or theft, you're totally free to do that. So Rabbaz says, if you're not trusted about yourself because you're not considered objective when it comes to yourself because you've got negias, then how come you're trusted when it comes to total financial ruin? And if we trust you to testify about yourself when it comes to finances, how come we don't test you when it comes to capital or corporal issues where there's going to be lashes or death sentence, right, Marcus or Mister? And the Rabbaz says something beautiful that I think every doctor should be aware of. He says the reason that you cannot incriminate yourself in capital or corporal matters is because it's not your body. That's why. Who the heck are you to testify to get this body lashed or life extinguished? It's not yours. But your money's yours. So you want to give edus in such a way that you have to pay money? Pay. It's your money. Of course you shouldn't waste it, but it's in your jurisdiction, halachically. Whereas your body is not, and that is the makor that he brings. And in the course of this discussion, Rabbi Zevin goes through many interesting makoros like that. And I actually wrote a book called Dangerous Disease and Dangerous Therapy. That's a very good book. You need to buy at least two copies if you want to understand it deeply. But in that book you'll find these makoros I mentioned, and that's of use, I hope, to doctors. That is documented in cases in which coercion is appropriate halachically, and where we would agree that you cannot force a person into treatment. So our basic approach is that your body is not yours, and that is why we don't have blanket permission to decide what is done with our lives and our bodies. So far, so good? Okay, now what are the exceptions? Where in halacha do you have an ability to decide what happens to you? So let me give a couple of examples. These are very important. And by the way, I just must mention as an aside that sometimes you actually have a chiyuv to do certain things to your body, not just not accept treatment in certain cases, right? For example, a painful issue at present is immunization of children. Right? Immunizing children. Children need to be vaccinated against diseases. In the Frum community today, there's a bit of a movement which is against immunizing children because there's a feeling that this is might be harming children and so forth. That's absolutely ridiculous. I once asked Rav Yoshi this myself. The incident, I mention it because I think it's current. is that I once was in practice in Israel, and I had a family, myself and the other doctor in the practice, where this family refused to immunize their children, right? They wanted the children, they said that you give kids vaccines, it's harmful, and it damages their immunity. They were very into homeopathic and naturopathic medicine. We tried to convince them to immunize the kids, no success. In the end, and I had an interesting experience. I was discussing with the father and the family the fact that the children need to be immunized, and a very interesting discussion came up. The discussion was that he said to me, look, if we immunize the children, what are the risks? According to your medical opinion, what are the risks? And I had to say that when it comes to the whooping cough vaccine, there is a theory, it is thought that there may be a risk. I don't know, is this still accepted today?
A risk.
So, you know, 20 years ago, the thinking was that you give a child a pertussis vaccine, you might have a 20, 30, 40,000 chance of the child not surviving due to the vaccine. Even today, in some places, they don't give kids with neurological histories, they don't give them the vaccine, right? Could be. Anyway, that was accepted at the time, that you give the kid the whooping cough vaccine, there may be a danger. Small danger, 1 in 20,000, something like that. So I said to the father, he said to me, so why are you going to give my child a vaccine for 1 in 20,000 risk of serious neurological damage or death? So I said to him, we do the math. The risk of the vaccine is 1 in 20,000. The risk of getting whooping cough is much greater than that. And for children under 12 months or so, 3 or 4% die. You know, it's a very serious illness, right? And therefore, that's a much greater figure than the kids who get the vaccine. And therefore, we do the math, and that's what we do. So the father refused to take the vaccine. So we agreed to Oscar Vidyashi. And late one night, you see, the problem is like this. The problem is like this, that in the discussion with the father, I realized that I was not telling him the truth. Because I told him that if we give your kid a vaccine, we give your child a 1 in 20,000 risk of dying. If we don't give your kid the vaccine, he has a much higher risk of getting whooping cough and dying. That's completely false. The truth is, if I don't give his kid the vaccine, the kid has zero chance of getting whooping cough. The reason is because all the other kids are immunized. And if all the other children are immunized, there'll be no outbreak of this disease, and his kid's safe. But is that fair? Is it fair for one child to be protected because everybody else has accepted the risk? That's an ethical question. That's a question. So we decided to ask Rav Yoshi. So that one night, I went into Rav Yoshi's room with the rov of our community and the other doctor, and we put the problem to him, and he said it's permissible to force the family to have the vaccine. You give a psak that they absolutely have to vaccinate the children. That's what he said. On the way out, I turned to Rav Yoshi, and I said to him, surely the rov said that, because it's not fair. It's not fair for one child not to be immunized. He said, no, that's not the reason. The reason is because immunizing children is normal. And right, he said to me, he said that in the furthest reaches of the third world today, little kids are immunized. They're totally normal. And as a Jew, you're mechuyev to do what is normal. Dash barabim and shomer tzayim Hashem. And therefore, you're absolutely mechuyev. When evidence comes in that is material, scientific evidence that there may be harm, you have to think differently. But you're not only, that means you are mechuyev to do what is broadly accepted as best practice, and you're negligent if you don't. He told me that parents who not immunize their children are behaving negligently, and they're chayev for that, right? That's what he said. Once, no, I'm telling you, he said it to me. It is in writing in my book now. So if you want it in writing, it's in writing. But I had the privilege of learning with Rav Zilberstein for many years, his son-in-law, and we once asked him the following question. We asked him this. I didn't ask Rav Yashir this. We asked Rav Zilberstein, what happens if a family, a doctor in all good faith, immunizes the child, and that child is harmed? What happens? You do what you ought to. You do what you have to do. It's dashbor rabbi, you have to do it. And you give your child, the child the vaccine, and this child gets a serious complication from the vaccine. What do you say? Listen to what he said. And what I'm about to say now, no questions. Okay, this is black belt Kabbalah. So, you can ask me about other things, don't ask me about this. He said that the principle is that you never suffer harm doing what you ought to be doing. And you'll never escape harm doing something illegitimate. Any harm that comes your way, that was destined for you, and nothing illegitimate will get you out of it. And here's the illustration. He told us that he had a nurse, a young frum nurse. She was assisting at an operation in Israel. Two chiloni gynecologists were operating on a woman who had an ectopic pregnancy. And they had to remove the fallopian tube. And during the emergency surgery, the one Israeli doctor said to the other one, this patient, religious lady, ridiculous. We told her to get sterilized. And we told her she had in danger of this pregnancy. She went with the rabbis and halachic stuff, and we were right, and she was wrong. And the nurse was very uncomfortable. On the one hand, the woman had asked her shayla, she wanted pregnancy, accepted the risk. But on the other hand, she's suffering an emergency. She didn't know what to say to the doctors. So she asked the Zilberstein what to say. He said, here's the answer. And the correct answer is, any harm you're suffering, was coming your way if you did what you ought to be doing. And no illegitimate movement is going to get you out of any tzaras that's coming your way. And the illustration he gave was this. The Medrash says that Shlomo Melech one day was asked by a certain person to teach him the language of the birds. Shlomo said, you don't want to do this, it's dangerous, there's all sorts of Isurim dust. But he begged him and he nagged him, he pestered him. Eventually Shlomo Melech taught the man the language of the birds. The man was overjoyed and he went out, and then he heard the birds saying that his chickens were going to die. So he sold all his chickens, and sure enough they died. He was very happy. Then he heard the birds saying his house was going to burn down. Sold his house, he was very happy, it burned down after he sold it. Then he heard the birds saying he was going to die. So he went back to Shlomo Melech and he said to him, what do I do? Shlomo said, you know there was a gzera in Shemayim against you, and Hashem tried to take it out on your chickens. Then you got out of that. Then Hashem tried to take it out on your house. You got out of that. Now there's nothing I can do. 30 seconds. Anyway, that's the correct approach. That's the correct hashkafa when it comes to that. But you are mechuyev to do absolutely what is necessary, what is normal, and you are mutter, it's mutter to do that which is called Ashbarabim in society. We had to talk about this today here to the doctors. And if you're interested, we can talk about that more. But that's the situation. And therefore, that is the standard. Of course, this only applies to minimal risk situations. We're not talking about where there's a higher risk. Then you need a special netarium, like the Gemara says, to earn a living. Eilav, when they say it's not sure, you can do things that are more dangerous when you have a reason, like earning a living, that you could not ordinarily do under the heading of Dashborah. And that's a whole subject in its own right. But where can you undertake risk and have a decision about what happens to your own body? So let me give you a classic example. What happens when somebody is terminally ill and we can offer them a procedure which, if it succeeds, will save their life, but if it fails, will kill them sooner than they would have died? So this person, let's say, they're what we call a Chaye Shoa. Rav Moshe Feinstein says Chaye Shoa means a year. Based on Rav Chaim Moshe talks about that. Others, Rav Yashiv said it doesn't have to be a year, but many points can take on. Chaye Shoa would be, let's say, a year. By the way, the Knesset defined it as 6 months. The committee, after asking Rav Yashiv, told the Knesset that in Halacha we should use the very important law, because in Israel there's a law passed in 1995, which is called 1998, which is called the Dying Patients Act. And that law allows you to withdraw treatment when the patient is, it's called Chok HaCholeh HaNotel Lamut, the law of the dying patient. And in that law, you can withdraw treatment from a patient who is a Chaye Shoa, which you cannot withdraw before. And not only that, you mechuyev to give palliative treatment, that means treat pain. And the law protects the doctor whose patient dies when he's legitimately trying to relieve pain. Right? Because a desperately ill patient, you're relieving pain, it can be dangerous. The drugs you give to relieve the pain can compromise their breathing. So the law protects you, provided you're acting responsibly. So very weighty life and death matter. And in halacha, we would regard that period as a year. The Knesset decided to call it 6 months. Can you imagine that? More conservative than the halacha. Because they felt it's not so easy to prognosticate about a year, but 6 months is easier. We don't want people withdrawing treatment and doing all these kind of desperate things when it's not so clear the person's dying. And so, incredibly, how often does that happen in Israel? Not that they did that. But be that as it may, I'm not here to defend the Israeli government, you understand? I'm not here to criticize them. I'm just pointing out. Right? That is the point. So if you have a patient who's terminally ill, by the way, it's very important not to be confused about this. If you don't know if the patient is terminally ill, then the halacha is don't do anything. This has to be absolutely clear. If you have a patient, you don't know if he's ill and your treatment will save him, or he's about to survive and your treatment will kill him, don't touch him. You should rather die because you failed to save him than die because you killed him. Well, you're not making any difference, right? You're walking down the street, you find a person who's had an accident, right? You stop. I don't know, do Americans stop? Got accidents? Huh? Probably don't want to get sued. South Africa, they don't stop because they don't want to get AIDS. In England, where I live now, they don't stop because they're too polite. But anyway, you stop, the person's lying at an air, he's got his neck at a weird angle, and he's gasping. And you can ask a neurosurgeon, it's not easy to decide. Is his neck broken and he's about to die? And if you straighten his neck out with gentle, professional traction, you'll save his life. Or is he hanging on, and when you move his neck, you kill him? Don't touch him. You should rather die because you didn't save him then die because you killed him. So Sheva Altas, there's no question. Again, when you're not shifting the percentages, you got 50% chance anyway. But if you're dealing with a person who certainly died, the Chaye Shoa, if you do nothing, he will certainly die, then you can do something risky, which will risk killing him sooner than he would have died otherwise, right? This is based on the Gemara. The Gemara says, that there were the four Mitzrayim, right? Famous Gemara. The other Mitzrayim, they were outside the camp in Shomron when the Machane Aram was attacking the Jewish people, and same as in the Novi, they were Gehazi and his three sons, in fact, and they were starving. The people, the Jewish, the Jews were starving in the Shomron, and they were starving in the hills. Tzaraas, they were banished from the camp, and they said to each other, we just read it as a Haftarah, right? Not like that. And they said to each other, what will happen if we remain here in the hills? We starve to death, maybe in a few days. Let us enter the enemy camp, where they may execute us summarily as Jews, or they may throw us a crust of bread and take us as slaves. Either could happen. And they decided to enter the enemy camp. And it happens, a whole series of nisim occurred, which is not the point of the story, but we learn from this, says the Gemara. You know, the shaila there in the Gemara is, can you go to a non-Jewish doctor who's a rabid anti-Semite, who knows how to cure you but might kill you? That's the question. Right? Unfortunately, times in history where that has been the case. So the Gemara wants to learn from this, might of the Zalat Mitzvah. Based on this Gemara, we paskin that you may put yourself into an immediate threat of being killed if you could save your life. Now, Moshe Feinstein asks the obvious question on this Gemara. What's the obvious question? What? How can you bring a riot from a showing? How can you bring a riot from a showing? Says Rav Moshe, as only he could. We're not learning a moral principle here, all we're learning is that it's a logical, intelligent option, and the Gemara means that you have the option. And he paskins that all poskim follow him on this, that it's up to the patient. It's up to the patient to choose. We say, it's up to you. Do you wish to prepare yourself and say goodbye to your family and die in 9 months' time? Do you undergo an operation tomorrow morning that will save you if it works and kill you tomorrow morning? It's up to you. That's what he said. There is a machlekes in the old poskim. Say you go back 200 years and you look into those poskim, there was a common opinion among many tshuvas then that it depends on the risk of dying during the procedure. In other words, 100% risk of dying without it. But with the procedure, there's a risk. What risk? So the older poskim used to say like this. You find many tshuvas like this. That if the risk of death from the procedure is more than 50%, it's awesome. It's awesome to undergo the procedure. Only if the risk of dying from the procedure is less than 50%, there's a rave chance you'll survive, then you can. I once asked Rav Moshe Shapiro about this, and he said that the svara is clear. The svara is anything that's more likely to kill you than save you, you cannot call a refuah. Got no right to go through a procedure that's more likely to kill than to heal. What kind of thing is that? You have to do a proper shtadlis. Proper shtadlis means something that's a refuah. By the way, he allows certain alternative medicines. I'm not certain alternative treatments. What is that? But it's got to be called a proper shtadlis. Something that's more likely to kill you than to save you, that's not called a refuah, and therefore you got it. Despite that, so all the modern poskim say like this, even if the risk of the procedure is greater than 50%, that means he's going to die without it, and probably will die due to the procedure. It's still mutter. The patient gets to choose. You have authority to choose here. There's a famous, amazing machlekes. How small does the chance have to be before it becomes awesome? So Rabbi Yashiv says 30%. Amazingly. I've never heard him say 30% about anything else. Here he says 30%. We asked him why. And he says the reason is because look at the Gemara. The Mitzrayim had three options. One option was dying in the hills. One option was entering the enemy camp and being saved. One option was entering the enemy camp and being killed and being saved. So there are three options. So it's a third, a third, and a third. So it has to be at least one third of the options have to be survival, unless they're not acceptable. That's what he says. However, I think what Rabbi Yashiv means, I don't think he means slavishly exactly 33%, because there's room for poskim to decide. Many say 10%, some say 20%. Chasam Sofer says 1 in 1,000. So there's plenty of room here for the Posek to decide based on many, many variables. But there's no question that all our modern Posek, Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe Feinstein, all agree that even if the risk of the procedure is more than 50%, since L'chaye Shah Loi Chai Shimon, that's the Lashon of the Gemara, therefore we can undertake a procedure provided the patient wants it. It's totally up to the patient. What do you do if the patient cannot just... No. He was just explaining this for of the earlier Posek. No, I've dealt with cases with him where we had risks like that, and no, that's clearly acceptable. I've never asked him how small the chance has to be. That's a different question. But your question is, what if the patient cannot decide? So here's the order of business. One, we ask the patient what he wants. Two, did he ever say what he wanted in a way that's clearly what would apply to him now? By the way, Israeli law has another unique feature here. In Israel today, you can go online and fill in an advance directive, which is a detailed instruction about what you want done to you in certain desperate circumstances. It's accessible, it has your name and your ID, Israeli ID number. It's accessible 24/7 at any point of care. If you brought in unconscious to an ER or someplace in Israel, access the computer immediately, and if you filled in this form, they will do what you have requested. The form is only valid if it's been updated within the last 5 years. because a lot of research has shown that what people say they want done to them when they're very ill isn't always, when they're younger, isn't always what they turn out to want when they're older. Secondly, it needs to be updated if you get a serious diagnosis, because a lot of research has shown that people don't always think the way they thought they might think when they'd be sick, when they actually are sick. But provided it's been updated within 5 years, and provided that it is updated if you had a serious diagnosis, then you will have to do what the patient said. And luckily, that's probably very acceptable, provided you're not choosing to do things that are acceptable, not like switch off machines, that you couldn't do. If there's no advance directive like that, then says Ramosha, in a clear tshuva, you ask the family. You ask the family. Whichever family member is the person would have probably relied on. And Ramosha says the sfora is that most people rely on their families. Most children rely on their parents to make the best decisions for them, and most parents rely on their children to make the best decisions, and therefore we can assume that the person would have asked a family member. We ask a family member either what they think the person would have wanted or what they think is best for the person, provided we can assume that the person would have relied on a family member's judgment. We're only talking about normal families, not people hovering around waiting for the inheritance, you know, problematic situations. So if it's a normal family, then we ask them what to do. By the way, as an aside, I find myself virtually constantly in terrible conflict in this area, because very often the family doesn't agree. Very often I work in the so-called Kiruv field. You're dealing with an elderly person who's a traditional Jew, who probably would not have wanted life support to be continued in an undignified fashion, may even have said so. They've got Balshiva kids who are extremely firm. The Balshiva often tends to go to an extreme. These kids are absolutely adamant that everything has to be done for the parent. The doctor doesn't know what to do. Conflict in family. Sometimes you have kids who are Balshiva and kids who are not, and you have violent arguments, life and death arguments in the family. There's a constant tension that we have. As another aside, fascinating, another observation about Israel is that in Israel today, when families have conflicts like that, you may not take the case to court. You may not take the case to court. The Knesset took a view that these are not legal matters. The United States, when you have people on machines and the family objects to it, they end up in the Supreme Court and they make massive. Israel decided these are ethical, religious, emotional, family matters. They're not legal, and you may not hear them in court. The way they decided in Israel is they've set up regional ethics committees around the country. The ethics committee consists of rabbonim, medical experts. You can co-opt somebody that you feel would be important to you on the committee. If you don't agree with the committee's decision, you can appeal it to a national ethics committee in Shalim. And if you don't agree with them, there's nothing you can do. The only way you can go to court is if you accuse the ethics committee of not behaving properly or making an improper decision. Then you can take it to court as a legal matter. But otherwise, the view they've taken, which is not unreasonable, is that these are not, you know, who knows what the Israeli chief, you know, justice would, who knows what they decide when it comes to halakha matters. Anyway, and therefore, that's what you do. So the next port of call is you ask family members, and you have to find a resolution with their disagreement. And this happens all the time. I mean, a few months ago, I got a call from a doctor in London. The doctor tells me, she's a lady palliative care expert. She tells me, here's my problem. I've got a 72-year-old Jewish lady, suddenly collapsed with widespread carcinoma of the ovary. She didn't know she was ill before. She's in my intensive care. She's on tubes and all sorts of life support stuff, sedated, heavily drugged. And the family, and this lady, this 72-year-old lady, clearly would not have wanted to continue in a situation like that. She would have wanted us to stop treatment. And the children admit that the mother probably would have wanted that. But she's got a son and a daughter who are Balshiva, and they are doing anything to keep the mother going. So the doctor said to me, I said to her, how do you know what the patient wants? She said, because me and the other consultant, what you call the attending, we walked over to, this is English, listen to this. She said, you know, they've got to get the patient's opinion and consent, right? She said, we walked over to the patient and we said to her, dearie, this is England, right? Dearie, if you become poorly, you know, in America you have truth done, lady, you're going to die, you know, do you want us to kill you? You know, that's how they say. In England, dearie, if you become poorly, would you want us to continue? And she shook her head. That's called consent, by the way. In a shocked, drugged, ill patient, right? That's called consent. Anyway, the kids are ready to admit that that probably is what the mother wants. So the doctor said to me, what am I supposed to do? So I said to her, you know, in Jewish law, you're calling me. In Jewish law, it's not what the mother wants, and it's not really what the children want. It's what God wants. Long silence. Long silence. Then she says to me, she said, look, I respect that, but I have to follow British law. And in British law, I have to do what the patient wants. And the patient does not want to continue, and I'm pretty clear about that. So I think I'm going to stop treatment. So the kids threatened to sue the hospital. And they continued treating, and 3 days later she died. You know, but you get conflicts like that on top. Sometimes, I must say that when you conflict with the law of the land, usually they admit that we occupy the high moral ground. They don't accuse us of being immoral. They accuse us of being doing too much or spending too much money. But they don't accuse us of being immoral, especially when you put your position clearly, you stand up for your principles. I've been in the situation many times. I was a doctor in America, I've worked in Israel, I've worked in South Africa. You're dignified, you know your stuff, you present it clearly. When it's not an emergency, they have to respect your position. Sometimes it gets a bit angry. For example, a couple of years ago in England, we had a young man who was very badly head injured, young childless couple, and he was in intensive care in a big hospital, and he was clearly brain dead. I was there during the brainstem testing. He was clearly brainstem dead. Now, in British law, that's called dead. In halacha, as you know, it's a very, very vexed issue. So I'm sitting there in the intensive care. The patient is there on his respirator, his brainstem dead. His badly shocked wife sitting next to him. And in the room, a couple of other rabbis and one or two other from doctors and one or two rabbi doctors. And the ICU attending walks in and he says, "This patient's dead in British law. I'm switching off the machine." We said, "Look, doctor, in our law, you know, we have a right to our opinion, and in our law, he's not yet dead, and we won't continue to treatment." He said, "You Jews are immoral. The reason is today, the 24th of December, and he's the only patient in my ICU. And you are asking me to keep my Christian nurses here on their religious festival for a dead patient." And very tense. At that moment, the head of the ICU walked in, and he said to this doctor, "What are you doing? These Jews have a right to their religious beliefs." They kept the machines going, and 6 hours later, the heart stopped. But you know, you can get moments like that. But usually, they admit that we are, you know, in fact, when I present medical halachic stuff around the world in hospitals, the non-Jewish doctors are blown away. They're blown away. The Jews kind of sit there. The Jews enjoy seeing how the non-Jews think this is incredible, right? Like, yeah, it's amazing. But the non-Jewish doctors are just blown away to hear such a cogent, cohesive, organized approach that is consistent, that's based on fundamentals and principles, right? It's a pleasure to do that.
We rely on the patient.
Listen to this. I told you that in Israel, you can force a patient into treatment. Exactly that situation. It's like this. When the person is mentally incompetent, they don't have capacity, as it's called. You get a psychiatrist, assess the patient, they're not competent. Then you can force them. You declare them legally incompetent and you force them. What that's clear, that all countries allow, and we try that whenever we can. What happens when the patient is clearly competent but making a clear misjudgment? They're competent, but they're terribly depressed, right? Terribly depressed, and therefore they don't want to eat, they want to die, but they're clearly competent. So in all Western countries, there's nothing you can do. You can't even force them to eat. So Israel has a law that you can force patients like that. And here's the conditions. The person's got to be terminally ill. The treatment's got to be life-saving. There's got to be no reasonable alternative treatment. Is there a reasonable alternative the patient allowed to choose? And fourth, you must make a decision that if you force them, they will later thank you. The law wants you to be a nobby. Why? Very logical. Because if you think this patient is making a very bad decision because they're in pain, because of depression, and they will agree with you later that what you did was reasonable, then you can assume they agree. This will not cover a person who doesn't want a blood transfusion because of religious convictions. They will not agree later. They will curse you later because they say, you broke my religion. But a person, and therefore, that's when you invoke the law, right? No other country has a law like that. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago in Shaare Tzedek, they had a 23-year-old girl with cancer. She was expected to live for less than a year, and suddenly she got an acute bowel obstruction. She needed emergency surgery to release the obstruction, and she would have survived comfortably for whatever months she had, refused surgery. They said to her, "You're going to die an agonizing death in 2 or 3 days. Well, let us do the simple operation. I'm not signing, nothing doing." They could not convince her to undergo the operation. They forced her, they held her down, anesthetized her. Against her wishes, they invoked the law. She was clearly competent, and they saved her life. The next morning, she crawled down to the hospital florist and bought a big bunch of flowers for the doctors who saved her life. So they said to her, "Why did you refuse surgery?" She said, "I was too ashamed to tell you. I have a phobia of needles. I was too afraid to have the injection for anesthetic. I would rather have died," right? That is a very good use of the law. There are countries where if you cannot get a signature, the girl would have died. Sometimes you don't need the law. In Terry, about 10 years ago, there had a 75-year-old lady who had gangrene of a leg. She needed emergency operation to amputate the leg. She would have survived. She said, "I'm not having this leg amputated." They said, "Why not?" She said, "I lived with this leg. I'm dying with it." They said to her, "Lady, What kind of thinking is that? She said, I'll tell you what. If you cut my leg off, how long will I live? I'm 75, a few more years. I'm going to have to shemayin. I don't want to walk up there forever, walk around up there forever without a leg. They said to her, that's not the right way. She said, don't tell me, I lived with this leg, I'm dying with it. She was a Sephardi lady, so they got Rabbi Yosef, when he was the chief, he traveled up to Tveria, he sat at the bedside, and he said to her, I promise you, that if you have your leg cut off now, in Shemayim, she said, Rabbi, that's what you say, I'm signing consent, she signed the surgery, they amputated her leg. That was just a little religious education that was necessary. It didn't need the law. So that law deals exactly with this. But very briefly, what I was talking about was where the person's guaranteed to die, and we can do a risky procedure, you have total jurisdiction, where you're competent to. If there's no family member to ask, the final port of call, says Rav Shlomo Zalman and others, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, that what we do is we assess what the common person in that society would have wanted. Right? I don't know what you call it in America. I think you call it John Doe or somebody. You know? In Britain, it's called the man on the Clapham Omnibus. You know? I never met him, but you know, the average Joe in the street, you ask him, what would say of a newborn child with multiple surgical problems that is not going to survive for 6 months, but with painful surgeries, they'd survive for 8 months. Most people would say that's not the right thing to do. And once there's a clear consensus like that, then although there's no one to ask, that, by the way, Ramosha writes, that when parents abandon the child, and others take over the care of the child, the parents lose the right, and the people who take care of the child get the right to make the decisions for the child. And there have been many, many cases like that. Anyway, that is the... Do you know Rav Ullman's story? No? Rav Ullman's daughter, Tova. Right? She was married for many years without children. And she's married to Rabbi Michael Katz, a South African. And for many years they never had children. And one night, late at night, they got a call from a hospital in somewhere in the south, here, where a Jewish surgeon who worked in that hospital had had a child who had certain abnormalities. He had certain anatomical abnormalities and heart problems, kidney problems, almost certain the child was not going to survive. And the parents just rejected the child. They could not take him. Remember, they had another child with serious illnesses. They could not take the child home. They left the child in the hospital. And a Christian nurse agreed to adopt the child. Right? And she signed, all the papers were ready to be signed. And there was a Jewish social worker in that ward. And she knew that this is probably not right. So she called up Tova Katz, who was living in Florida at the time, knowing she didn't have any children. She said, there's a Jewish child about to be adopted by a Christian nurse. Would you consider taking the child? She phoned her father in Israel. She said, Abba, is it important that a Jewish child should hear Kiddush? And things like that. He said, yes, do it. They flew down to, I think it was Atlanta. They flew down to Atlanta the next morning. They met the surgeon and his wife before the nurse signed the papers. He was only too happy to have the child go to a Jewish family. They adopted the child, recovered fully within months. And she had children after that, one after another. And Rav Ullman said, you changed his muzzle, and he changed yours. Right? Anyway, that's right. So, that is the situation. So, that is one area in which you can make a decision to, you can make the decision about your life. And finally, unless you have any questions, another case where you can opt is to withdraw treatment when a person is dying. The person has a right to say that I don't want to continue suffering, and you can withdraw, well, let's put it this way, you can withhold treatment, and certain things you can withdraw. You can never withdraw something that is keeping the patient actively alive. You can never switch off a ventilator or stop an IV that is keeping the patient. You can't do something that shortens their life, but you cannot give the next dose of life-saving medication. You cannot put them on a ventilator. You cannot do the next session of dialysis, right? And you can withhold certain kinds of treatment, provided the person is terminally ill, suffering uncontrollably, and does not want to continue. Terminally ill, not like the first patient that Dr. Kevorkian killed. Right? She was a Janet Atkins. She just had early Alzheimer's disease. She could no longer play a good game of tennis with her son. I can no longer play a good game of tennis with my son. That's why I don't play. You know, that's not a reason to die. I mean, you might feel like it is, but it's not. You know. So that is got to be terminally ill. Suffering uncontrollably, which should never happen. We've got enough drugs to take care of any degree of suffering. Problem being that sometimes it's dangerous. But all the post-schemes say that you are acceptable, even obliged, to accept the danger when the alternative, when the person is suffering terribly, even though it's dangerous, provided you're giving the drug, the morphine, to reduce the pain and not kill the patient, which happens. Secondly, only the most qualified doctors are allowed to do it, because Shulchan Aruch brings clearly, black on white,
and no doctors are allowed to treat a patient where there's a more qualified doctor around to do so. Not like in modern academic medicine where juniors get taught because they need to learn. That's wrong. But the most important, the most senior doctor. There are many exceptions to that. So I'll tell you the exceptions. When the top doctor is fully occupied, the second most is allowed to work. Or when the procedure is well within the capacity of the junior, or when the senior is in direct responsibility and guidance, then the junior can do a procedure. But other than that, the patient gets the best. And when you're trying to titrate the pain medicine against life and death, right, it's a delicate balance, it needs to be the most experienced pair of hands. Now Moshe says, what's the sfora for giving a pain relief which might kill the patient? Normally, you can do a dangerous procedure to save them. You're not saving them, it's relieving pain. What gives you the right to take a danger? He says, because pain is not innocuous. When a person is desperately ill, the pain is going to make them die sooner. And therefore, when you treat the pain, you're not only being humane, you're actually taking off part of their lethal burden. Because a very ill person who is desperately in pain or abandoned or hopeless, they die sooner. And any good doctor knows that the person's emotional status is clearly related to their survival. And therefore, you give the pain relief. So again, if they are terminally ill, suffering uncontrollably, all unconscious with no hope of ever regaining consciousness, right? Machlekes, that between Rabbi Yashiv and Shlomo Zalman, how that works exactly, but we paskin this way. No hope of reincarnation, and under those circumstances, does not want to continue. They are free. In fact, you're obliged, says Rav Moshe, not to treat, to continue their agony. When they don't want to continue, you're obliged not to treat them in those circumstances, and you're forbidden to resuscitate. Because if you're waiting for them to die, you don't resuscitate them. You have to resuscitate, DNR, somebody asked, when you're obliged to treat. But when you're not obliged to treat, you're not allowed to resuscitate. This does not apply to food, liquid, basic internal homeostasis, oxygen, any standard drug that the person was getting, insulin, thyroid, anything. The Rambam writes that medicine is as natural as food. Anyone who doesn't take a medicine is as foolish as somebody saying, I'm not going to eat, Hashem will keep me alive. It's ridiculous. And therefore, you have to... What? If it's a staple medicine, I'm not talking about a gosis. I'm talking about a person who's terminally ill, and they're getting a staple food, oxygen, basic medicine they needed before, like insulin, etc. Cannot stop that. You don't let a person die because you withdraw a basic need, but you don't do surgery, chemotherapy, that you don't do. And there's an argument about blood products, transfusions, and about antibiotics. I'm not going to go into that, but that is another place where a person can choose to die when they are unconscious or when they are, and if they cannot make a decision, we do what we said before in terms of family members and so on. I'm going to stop here in case you have any questions. There's lots more to say. Yes.
How pushy should you be to get the thumbs up? You know, when you're in the hospital with your kid and, you know, top doctors, you're not even there. How insistent should you be?
So we asked Rabbi Yashiv this question, and he made some very interesting comments about this. And it was Yerushalayim also. First of all, not mechuyev to have the best. You're mechuyev to have a level of excellence in care that everybody would agree is excellent. Right? Again, the fact that there's somebody else better, and especially when it involves overseas travel or unbelievable expenditure. Right, all persons say there's no chiyuv to make a family financially destitute to go overseas. Like in our case, it usually involves coming to America where there's no insurance and you're talking about fortune being expended, where in the local country there is perfectly good expert. It may be true that there's a world expert someplace else. So the standard isn't the very best in the world. The standard is a standard of care that everybody would agree is excellent standard of care. In some rare circumstances, one is obliged to travel because there is only one expert in the world who has enough experience in this particular thing. I'm often involved in that sort of field. And there's people who are much more experienced than me, Rabbi Fira and others, whose job it is to know the one expert in the world who knows about this rare disease. There you virtually have no other option. Right? Rabbi Yashi says, for example, it's not so posh that you can go collect soccer funds to take a patient overseas to care. Of course, the people who want to give this doctor for that, that's fine. But you can't misrepresent that when there's adequate care in your country, and now these, you understand, to go to a country where it would be much more expensive, where there isn't. So that becomes a question of judgment. How much better is the best? As a general rule, you should try for the best, especially if you're not qualified to know, you know, exactly what that is. But there's not, that's not the criteria.
Yeah, but if you have the resident doctor on the floor and the chief and the higher one,
it depends what the problem is. If you're dealing with something standard that the resident is good enough in that circumstance, that's fine. If you're dealing with something that takes more maturity or a delicate situation, a little baby, babies and elderly people, we always push into a more serious category of pikuach nefesh. You have to know, if you're in doubt, do everything you can, obviously. Also, sometimes delicate situation, because when you become difficult, you antagonize the staff, and that isn't always best for the care. So when you insult the local doctor because he's only a resident or an attending, and you tell him, you have to be very careful about that, because very often the real day-to-day care on the ward, the nursing staff, it's very good to have them on your side. So who knows how much damage you do to the care. That's delicate, doesn't it? Delicate. Yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
To choose a full Jewish doctor over, let's say, a person who has no beliefs at all, or anything, or the Maariv Shas, whatever you'd like to say.
Yeah.
Did the religious union play any part at all in the person's thinking that?
First, can talk about this question. The question is the Indian to choose a Jewish religious doctor as opposed to thing? On the contrary, if the non-Jewish doctor is better, you want him. There's a question on Shabbos, where you're going to choose a religious Jewish doctor, the Chilul Shabbos will be less. Even then, the poskim say you can choose a Jew who will be Mechalel Shabbos, because it's really mutter for him to be Mechalel Shabbos. There are svaras, risk svaras, to say that if he would have been breaking Shabbos anyway, he doesn't have the heter now that he's breaking Pekhlana. But basically, we paskin that Rav Moshe Feinstein said you can switch a duty with a non-frum doctor for you on Shabbos, even though he's Jewish and he's going to be breaking Shabbos. It's a good idea, because he would have been going to the beach and the movies. Now he's Mechalel Shabbos for a sick patient, and he's not doing it for you, he's doing it for the patient. He's doing you a favor, but he's doing the melacha for the patient. So on the contrary, if the non-Jewish doctor is better, then you want him and not the Jewish doctor. All else being equal, you want the doctor to understand the value of life like we do, and that would be better. But if you've got a non-Jewish doctor who's clearly better, right? A non-Jewish doctor who wants to be the best in his field, he doesn't understand the value of life, let's say, like we do. He just wants to be the best. That's very good. He wants good results. That's just fine. Don't go to the doctor who wants to help mankind. You know, that's not good enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
The oneness of the response that you mentioned before, being that we're not in control of our body, therefore can't be made against ourselves.
When there's malchus or misa.
Right, so why could somebody else be made by us?
It's a mitzvah of the Torah.
Uh-huh.
That's a mitzvah.
Can we do it also?
Because also, excuse me, there's a halacha in the Torah that mechayev you to be made on somebody else. The Rambam says it's got nothing to do with Sforah. It's the din of the Torah. It's a gzeras hakosov. Who knows these animals telling the truth? You're going to kill somebody else. The Rambam says gzeras hakosov.
The Rambam says it's Sforah also.
What?
The Rambam doesn't say that. It says it's Sforah also.
It's Sforah.
Because we're equated that he's depressed in the Mara Nefesh.
Anyway, it's a clear mitzvah to be made, and it's awesome to hold back Adis. It's clear. On yourself, it's awesome. It's a mitzvah of the Torah. You mechuyev to give Adis on somebody, and you chayev if you don't give Adis.
Why don't I have a
chiyuv
to give Adis?
Because the Torah says it's awesome. You want me to second guess what he's, you know, the story? I don't know. That's first of all, they asked for it. That you got nigiyus by yourself, right? The poskim say that when it comes to your wife, for example, it's not even considered edus on someone else. It's not considered edus on yourself, as opposed to other craving. Yeah. By the way, do you know that in non-Jewish law, when a person confesses, right, to a murder, for example, they don't accept it automatically. The person might be trying to die to save somebody else. Right? Not so much. So, there are plenty of stories. Yeah.
Is there a
Hoyashas
part that's about 30% of survival?
But I think he meant it as a guideline. I think he means it as a guideline where there's room to judge. I don't think he means it's like exactly 33.3. Because I heard him say 20% in certain other cases of risk. 10 to 20% regards as a mute that's matsui. Under that he's not. I don't know how, you know. No, because when the chance of survival is so small, then you're basically throwing your life away, right? You've got 9 months to live, and almost certainly going to die tomorrow morning during the procedure. There's got to be some limit. Custom surface says 1 in 1,000. It's up to you. So there's a wide machlokes.
How can it be up to the patient to value manure?
How can it what?
How can it be timed that it's up to the patient to value manure?
Because here the story is like this. This person's terminally ill. L'chaye shal lo yichashin, and says the Gemara. He's suffering terribly. And the Stipler and Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman, they say you've got no right to force the person into ongoing suffering. The Stipler says you should tell the person what the value of life is and that it's worth it. And who knows who is keeping alive by this? He may be married the whole town and all sorts of things. But you can't force that on him. And then to force him into another treatment that prolongs his agony, right, that you can't do.
What's the pain?
Only when he's suffering terribly. I told you, he needs to be terminally ill, suffering terribly, and does not want to continue. Take away one of those. The doctor says, I'm suffering, but get me to that grandchild's bar mitzvah, do anything you have to, you do it. I'm talking about only where these things, or unconsciousness, the Meiri says, because a person is unconscious, I'll never have a thought even of tshuva at all. He says it in the Gemara where the you know, the person is buried under the rubble and you have to be mechal shabbos to get him out. That would be possibly useful. Yes.
There's no case where it's unconscious that you can hold back, take him off of the rest.
Let me make this clear. Is there any case where you can switch off a machine or take away something? So here's the rule. We didn't even discuss kasisa. Okay, kasisa is another whole story. That's another whole. We didn't talk about that. But when a person's dependent on a machine or an infusion or a ventilator, whatever it is, and you switch it off, you are killing the patient. That's completely also shvichas domi. When you chayv misa depends on whether it's a trefa or trefa b'dei adam b'dei shemayim. It's all when you chayv misa or not, but you definitely be basis. But definitely chayv misa for taking us question about that. Even if it's a trefa, it's also you definitely cannot do that. Rav Shlomo Zalman said that if the person's brain dead, there are cases where you can switch off the machine. But he was a das yachid on this, and the reason he said it was, he said a brain dead patient is either dead or a goises. If he's dead, you can switch off the machine. The goises, the Ramon says, that a goises, you can take away something that's artificially keeping them alive, because it's painful to be in a state of gezisa or be kabbalah, and therefore, if there's a noise going on externally, you can stop the noise. Said Rosh Hashanah, the ventilator is only an external interference with his dying. Now, we don't paskin that way because, I mean, when you need to, for example, where they need the bed to save somebody else's life, and the goyim are going to switch it off, you don't have to call the police, and there are circumstances like that. But he was the one who said that, and therefore, but to switch off a machine, but I'll tell you the most amazing, amazing thing. Amazing. If this doesn't move you, there's no hope for you. They are now building a machine in Israel, a ventilator that has a timer. And this is what it does. Person comes in, they've got respiratory failure, put them on the machine, it only works for a certain amount of time and then switches off automatically. Rabbi Dashiv approved, and I don't know any of the Rabbanim who don't approve. What they've done is they've built the machine already. Sharon Tzedek and Hadassah built it together. They've tested it on dummies, not in humans yet. They're waiting for final Knesset subcommittee approval to go human. And the system will be that you put the person on the machine, and 3 days later, 7th, whatever it is, the machine switches off. And in certain circumstances, you will not have to switch it on again. I'll explain. The point is like this. The wrong understanding is, it's just a cowardly way, right, of doing a groma. So, absolutely wrong. Because when you're standing by when that thing goes off, you have to switch it on again, otherwise you're over lois tamad al damreacha. Absolutely. But that's not the case. The case is like this. There are many places in the United States today where a person comes to us with respiratory failure, they get sent home to die. Reason? We worry that if we put them on a machine, we'll never get them off. The lungs will not recover, they'll get worse, they'll be on a machine. Month after month after month. And other people who could have been saved are not going to be saved. How do we handle this? We do our best to select the kind of patients that you think will survive. Right? As opposed to the ones you think that are not. But it's very hard to do that. Not even South African doctors always get it perfectly. Right? Although we almost always do. But what you are doing is, you are excluding patients that you think wouldn't make it. And no doubt there are a lot of people who don't make it, because here's the news for it. Don't do that. Yeah, people have sleepless nights doing that. Don't do that. When any patient comes in, put him right away on the machine. But you tell him the following information. My dear sir, your lungs are in bad shape. You've got two options. Go home and die. Or we'll put you on a machine that goes for 5 days. If your lungs show signs of recovery, we'll keep the machine going, we'll switch it on again. If your lungs prove to be hopeless, when it gets to end and it switches off, we will not switch it on again. What we will do is switch it on immediately on somebody else.
And that's not with some of them,
no, because I'll tell you why. Because Rav Zilberstein proposed this many years ago. I'll tell you why not. You've got a person on a machine, okay? The machine switches off. You know who you have to switch it on. But 1 second, right next to him is another patient who's a chai elam. You've got a machine, it's not functioning at the moment, it's switched off. You've got a chai shah and a chai elam. Kadima goes to the chai elam for sure. So why start it on him? In aloha, we would say, start it again. Okay? Probably we say start it again. This is the Israeli government doing this, not us. So it hasn't been agreed yet what the criteria will be. I was at Columbia, New York, some time ago. They told me they're now considering putting all their ICU ventilators onto timers so that they will not have to make these decisions. And it will be a societal agreement that the alternative is dying. This way you get a trial of therapy. and if your lungs prove that the recovery will treat you. But if you would have died anyway. By the way, they're about to run a trial. Do you know when they've selected for this trial? They've taken a group of Israeli patients who have neurodegenerative diseases, where they slowly get into situations of long to be able to breathe. And of those people, they've taken a subgroup who have signed that they do not want to be ventilated when they get to that situation, which is legal in Israel, in other words. What? Well, today tuberculosis is much more treated.
I'm talking about ALS, neurological diseases where there's no more nerves left.
So what they said like this, these people have signed that when they become terminally ill and cannot breathe, they refuse ventilation. They've gone to those patients and said, do us a favor, we respect your wishes, but just to help us prove this technology to save other lives, when you get to that situation, let us keep you alive for 1 week longer. We promise you at the end of the week we will let you die. But we'll keep you alive for 1 week longer to prove that we can save other people. And the people have said, of course, we can help other people, absolutely. And they've selected these people because nobody can accuse them of using the technology to kill people. You gave them an extra week of life. Right? And if it works, and I have no doubt that soon coming to a hospital near you will be this technology, because... That's a good question, but as it happens, it took amazing amount of time to develop the technology. It was an unbelievable technical challenge to get the machines right. Why not? Go to Home Base, what do you call the name there? Home Depot. Go to Home Depot, buy a shower clock, stick it in the wall, put the balance in. What's the problem? I could do that in 2 minutes. Can you imagine what the problem was?
No.
The problem was like this. No, the problem was if you trip the power to an ICU ventilator, it refuses to switch off. It starts bleeping and squawking and alarming. It's got backup batteries. It refuses to switch off. They made so they don't fail. When you put your Walmart, what's it called, your home depth, you put your Shabbos clock and you switch it off, the thing goes crazy. So the Israelis had to come up with a circuitry that will not override the alarms and the fail safes, but will agree to be silent when you want it to. Not as a life and death, nothing to issue. They're now confident that their technology is reliable enough, and they're about to go human. I'm virtually no doubt this is what we're going to see.
How is that different
from the old days when it's not suction? Yeah. So Ramosha wrote in an old shiva that in the old days when they changed the oxygen bottles, not like today with central oxygen supply, then if the patient was brain dead and making no effort to breathe, and you observed that when the machine was off, you didn't have to put the oxygen back on. Today there's a version of that that some ways can say when you take off the ventilator to suction them, that's a good time to do the brainstem death testing. The problem is, I asked Rabbi Feinberg about this once, and he said, who knows that there wasn't a small respiratory drive, and the stress of this thing has killed the patient and taken away that drive. Don't do that. So when we can avoid it, you understand, the apnea testing itself might be extinguishing the last flicker of life in the brainstem. And therefore, if possible, we do that.
But there aren't in line now anyway. So
what?
Most of them are in line anyway.
Yes, yes. But even if you did disconnect it for a minute while you suction, etc., etc., we would try to keep it in. Yeah.
What guidance can you give to a young person regarding the advance directive, especially considering that it could be an emotional decision, it could be maturity issues, especially like you said before, as life progresses. The decision that a person at 20 may say that, you know, if I was terminally ill and in pain, may make a very different decision when he has a wife, children, later on in life. So as far as advice regarding what resource to make that decision, or should somebody in their 20s and 30s, especially in our communities where we have extended family, have the capacity and the follow up.
So the question is, what does one recommend to people about making advanced directives? I don't think I have much to say about that. I know there are rabbinical associations in America that draft these things in ways that accord with various brands of halacha. Shaaret Tzedek has a donor card, for example, about giving organs, where you check which organs you mean, and the last checkbox says, under competent halachic guidance. And you can specify which halachic guidance you mean. Provided that the advanced directive is going to help and not harm, because you know in this country they'll switch off machines so they can use your organs, problematic, right? Or if the United States introduces laws that deem every citizen to have agreed to transplant unless you opt out, then you'll definitely need an advance directive so they don't switch off machines inappropriately. I don't know enough about this. If they're acceptable advance directives, then you change them as you...
I was asking specifically regarding the DNR. There are advance directives, and they're just saying the DNR is such a... That's something where it's such an emotional thing.
Right.
And especially with family, it's not something to be filled
out. So let me say about a DNR, I strongly suggest one should not do those. And I'll tell you the reason. The reason is that when there's a big red DNR on the chart, often the patient gets less treated. The staff reads that as, I don't really want to live as much as somebody else. which is not what it means. It means if I die, don't get me back again, right? Under certain circumstances. But DNR has that subtle suggestion, although very many hospitals try to educate strenuously against that attitude, a lot of research has shown. So to just have an automatic DNR broadcast a certain kind of a message, so as a blanket principle, I don't think that's a good idea.
What's the general rule of thumb if you, like you said, you're supposed to get the best doctor,
you're asking
a rule of thumb, what's the general?
The question is, what happens when you have, on the one hand, a hospital that's good and the patient's well known and so on and so forth, but you have an expert someplace else and they don't know him and there's the danger of moving the patient, etc. You're asking a medical decision here. You know, there's not a halachic issue. You're asking a medical, it happens all the time in medicine. Is the risk worth this change, this movement, right? The general principle, if you want one, the general principle is that you ask the doctors. If you get a second opinion and he doesn't agree, you ask a third, and you go with the roof. Right? That's a general principle. I'll tell you an interesting mind. Maybe we can finish with this? Is it? We're good? Yeah. Let me tell you the mind. One morning, I walked into my home in Jerusalem early in the morning. I get a phone call from a doctor across the world at a bedside. Doctor tells me, I've got a patient here who's dying. He's got a heart valve infection. Needs emergency surgery, replace a heart valve. Fine. The question is, what type of valve do you use? Do you use a plastic valve or a pig valve? Now, there's no problem with a pig valve, okay? Do you use a pig valve, that's good. The problem is, if you use a plastic valve, they last forever. The trouble is, but if you use that, you need blood-thinning medication, which is dangerous. If you don't take enough, the valve will clot. If you take too much, you could bleed. Serious problem. If you use a pig valve, you know, medication, they work perfectly. You may find this a little offensive, but pig tissues, you know, are just like human tissues, and they do great in the human body. So that's the discussion. What do you use? So the doctor tells me, I'm standing at the bedside. The cardiologist is one of the best in America. He's a South African, of course. He has said that I think we should use a plastic valve. And the heart surgeon, who's about to do the operation in 2 hours' time, agrees he should use a plastic valve. But these two doctors, in their humility, went to ask a third opinion, because they work in a hospital where there's a world-famous cardiologist, who's much older than them. He wrote all the textbooks, and he's clearly a world authority. So these two excellent doctors, they went to ask, and this doctor came in and he saw the patient, and he said, use a pig valve. So they phoned me in Shulan to ask me, what holds sway in halacha? A majority of competent opinion, or a minority of superior opinion? So I thought to myself, it's a Gemara Baba Masir. Big Tom Chacham, I said, it's a Gemara Baba Masir. When Rabbi Yeshua was in the majority, and Rabbi Eliezer was in the minority, right? So he's Lo B'Shamayim, and Rabbi Eliezer, you know, Gemara. So the walls are caving in, and there's a tree walking backwards and forwards. What? So they said that you don't go with Rabbi Eliezer, right? They put him into Cherem. So that's what I think to myself. But I was able to get hold of Rabbi Yashi that day within 20 minutes. Roch Hashem, within 20 minutes, I was back on the phone. Rabbi Lashi said, the patient gets to choose. And I met the patient there, and he told me he is so thrilled that he chose a plastic valve to think. See, the problem is that the pig valve, although it functions normally, 10 to 20% of them need to be replaced in 10 years' time. To think of going through that again, he doesn't want to do it. What is Rabbi Lashi's for it? The Gemara is dealing with Torah. In Torah, Zachar Rabbim Lattes. So you follow the roads. No question, Rabbi Yezah is the Gonel, Rabbi Yezah is the Gonel. The Torah says you follow the roads. But in medicine, they're not shuffling in the tzias like in Torah. In Torah, the Torah says you follow majorities. You follow majorities, what Hashem wants. A bus call comes every outside the bus call. Right? Doctors may feel like they can outside the bus call, but that's not the way it works. In medicine, the doctor is doing his best to assess reality. In Torah, the psak is making the tzias. Right? And therefore, you go, there's both are reasonable. I'll tell you why, because all doctors agree that plastic valves and pig valves are both extremely reasonable. The question is, which package of risks do you want? In young patients, we often use a plastic valve because they're going to have to. Because you use a pig valve, you may operate 3 or 4 times.
But the elderly would have agreed with. There would have been one good doctor and the better doctor also saying that one loses.
There's no
chance.
I'll tell you why. If the doctors would have argued about a life and death difference, then there's no question we have to assess the pikuach nefesh aspect. But when all the doctors agree that both approaches are extremely reasonable, it's a question of which risks and balances. The patient's motivation is very important. Okay, last question. Yeah.
Today, many women are becoming nurses. Let's say a young lady finds herself a nurse in a nursing home or someplace where they're following American law, and they're told, the home is telling her not to give this patient food, and the patient's going to die, and she's watching the person die.
Yeah. So the problem,
what should she do?
The problem is when a nurse, this is only nurses, it's everybody, doctors, you have to go against the halacha. So dinner de malchus a dinner, but it's not applied to pikuach nefesh, no question about it. Now, whether it's a Jewish or non-Jewish patient, how far you have to go in this is a discussion. You need to make your policy clear, and you need to say this is not acceptable, and I can't do this. You cannot do an issue, and you cannot do a loisamod when somebody needs to be saved or fed. It pays to make your position clear before it's an emergency, and what usually happens in practice is they say, thank you very much, we'll find somebody else. Today in America, Catholic doctors and nurses will not provide contraception. They will not do morning after, you know, abortion, etc. They won't do abortions. They won't assist at abortions and some sterilizations. They have their religious rights. You're a religious Jew. The nurse has to tell them, I'm not allowed to participate in this. They'll say, thank you, we'll find someone else. She doesn't have to call the police and lie down on the floor till they drag her away, right, if they're going to find someone else who can do it. But you cannot be party to something that is clearly a life and death matter. Thank you very much.